Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for May 19th, 2022. And last week I left off, I didn't quite finish my train of thought, and so I'm going to finish that. I was talking about the paper, Dynamics of a Small Comet, 1986, the ISWE3 satellite going to Comet Jacobini-Zinner, and then I was talking about a few comments more about that paper, but then also about the flotilla of the issue of the Giotto spacecraft going to Halley's Comet and with a camera and flying on the sunward side of the comet nucleus of Halley. And there was an incident there where Fred Whipple was in the control room in the European Space Agency control room, and it was the French that put this together. It wasn't the complete space agency of the European Space Agency. It was primarily French. They put together the Giotto spacecraft, very well-designed spacecraft to look at a dirty snowball, but not designed to go out and look at a plasma discharge comet. So they really did not know what they were doing, but oddly enough, they decided to fly to the sunward side of the nucleus, which for the time was very interesting and very strange because it was believed that all the activity was in the tail end of the comet. But there were three other spacecraft going through the tail of Comet Halley. And I should jump forward a couple decades here now, going into the time frame of 2014. Now, in 2004, the Rosetta mission launched from the European Space Agency to go out to a comet. It's too long a name to pronounce. I never get it quite right. But at any rate, the 67P, we just use that abbreviation, Comet 67P. And the idea was to orbit the comet and see activity. Now, the orbit was an elongated orbit between 10 and 30 kilometers, so an elliptical orbit. And two things, I'm going to talk about that in greater detail when that time comes. But two things, at the Paris Air Show following that, 2015, the head of the project of the Comet Group, the French Comet Group, was sitting at basically a news conference. And they were asking questions and talking about it. And he put his head down and he said something in a quiet voice. He said, "I have been studying comets, of course, all of his life." He was the head comet man for the European Space Agency. And he stated, he said, everything we knew about comets was wrong. And he basically stated the dirty snowball comet model could not be correct. Something else was going on. And then I talked to a woman who was the head, one of the head researchers on the project, and I asked her, how close to the nucleus were you able to measure material in the form of clouds of material or plasma or whatever? In other words, water and ice, etc. She said the closest they were able to detect water and ice to the comet nucleus was about 10 kilometers away. There was a region about 10 kilometers around the comet nucleus where there was no water or ice at all. And of course, the nucleus was black as coal, and they landed on the comet nucleus. They actually had a lander that went down. They lost it for a little while, then they regained contact with it. It sampled the material from the surface of the comet nucleus. There was no ice, there was no water, there was no snow. It was organic compounds, sort of an organic dust. And so anyway, the concept that they're still talking about little icy wanderers, etc., is just totally bizarre. But I want to go back to the Giotto spacecraft. And I'm going to, this is from my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes. And it's actually a three-part play that I wrote. It's a Grimm fairy tale in three acts. And Grimm, typically the fairy tales of Grimm is spelt with two M's, but here I spelt it with one M indicating it's a sad story. Let's put it that way. So Fluff, Fluffier, and Fluffiest is a three-act play or constantly revising reality to protect accepted theories at all costs by James McKinney. Act 1. It happened in an instant. It was 1986 and the European Giotto spacecraft, the only satellite going to Comet Halley that had an onboard camera, was approaching that famous comet's nucleus through the clouds of dust and gas that surrounded it. As the available sunlight faded due to the dense clouds eclipsing the solar light, the only light came from the comet nucleus still buried deep in the cloud. Clue number 1. Why is the comet nucleus illuminated when the sunlight is blocked by dense comet coma? And so the question there is, how can this cometary process proceed with the sunlight hitting the comet nucleus and sublimating this material off of it when the sunlight is blocked by this dense coma that surrounds the sun? It's a self-defeating process. Okay, so I'm going to continue reading here. Could this be a self-luminous object with an energy source other than sunlight, the plasma discharge current striking the comet nucleus? And clue number 2, how can the comet continue to form a tail from solar radiation sublimating ices off the comet nucleus when the sunlight is so completely blocked by the dense comet coma? The alleged process seems to be at best self-defeating. No one at NASA or ESO or Harvard or Yale or Cornell or JPL or anywhere else can even, or not even the news media, thinks to ask such a difficult question, as they're all beaming with the right stuff. On with our story. An aging Fred Whipple, originator of the Dirty Snowball Comet model, has been invited to witness the confirmation of the Dirty Snowball Comet model. All of the calculations have been done, all of the journal articles have been refereed, and all of the PhDs have been given. To the bright new crop of comet scientists at all the best universities, after years of hard study, the sales of books written by NASA scientists were brisk, and the public had purchased and read and applauded TV specials and aired days before the famous flyby of this famous comet. A comet was said to be a sparkling white snowy ball with some dust that was released as the sun's heat burned off the outer layers. Artists' full-color artwork dramatically reproduced the scientists' expectations and predictions. The Giotto spacecraft moved closer to the comet nucleus, sending back picture after picture, each one better defining the pure white potato-shaped snowball. Excitement rose and fever pitch was as small jets could now be seen, and the pure white nucleus became better defined with each returning photo. At last, as the pure white nucleus that Whipple and all the other scientists knew had to lie in the center of all of this dust and gas became clearly defined, Whipple screams out on international television, "It's the nucleus! There it is! It's the nucleus!" Just then, the Giotto spacecraft broke through the final layers of gas and dust to reveal what is now known to be the darkest, blackest object ever photographed by any spacecraft in the history of the space program. Silence and shock filled the direct feed television, and Giotto's picture broke up. Something terrible had gone wrong. There was no snowy nucleus. What was it? How could all the refereed journal articles be wrong? The nucleus was not a loosely packed dirty snowball, but it was a pitted, burnt, carbonaceous chondrite rock. Dead silence filled the room. Seconds later, the Giotto spacecraft started to gyrate wildly out of control, and the last signals received from it, with the electron particle counter off scale, circuits in overload, and the magnetic sensors off scale. Surely the spacecraft had been designed to exceed all expected criteria by the comet specialists at ESO and NASA. An intense electron beam had hit Giotto. Giotto was temporarily rendered inoperable as it passed directly to the sunward side of Comet Halley's nucleus. But from where could such an electron beam come from? The Dirty Snowball theory never said anything about anything like that. Act 2, Fluffier. The theorists worked feverishly throughout the night to recalculate in an attempt to make the theory fit the data. No attempt was made to look at alternative comet theories, and no one dared mention that the cherished Dirty Snowball Comet model might be incorrect. One scientist postulated that if the snow and ices were in deep pits in the surface of the nucleus, then we wouldn't see them, but the solar radiation might penetrate and eke them out. "Yay!" everybody exclaimed, and by morning the slightly dirtier than expected but still Dirty Snowball Comet model was reconstructed. Science news media specialists quickly constructed apologetics articles stating that the nucleus was a bit dirtier than expected, but nonetheless a Dirty Snowball Comet model had been confirmed. Of course, by the proponents, who had no opposition since they had fired and destroyed the careers of anyone who had objected over the past 20 years. Now let's look at how far this theory had to be stretched to make things fit. Prior calculations never took into account that there would be so little solar radiation at the comet nucleus. So right there, we are dealing with a factor of thousands of times less energy than originally calculations needed to make this Dirty Snowball Comet model work in the first place. And now they were confronted with the slight but never insurmountable problem that the snow and ice was not even visible on the nucleus of the comet, and most could not have been located over more than 1 to 2% of the surface area. The sunlight now had to burrow in and ferret out the ice in these hidden pockets. With less light energy than a Christmas tree bulb at a distance of 100 feet, they had to somehow show that tons of ices were sublimated per second. Additionally, certain areas had enough force to blast dust out with such force that the jets would be visible from Earth a mere 100 million miles away. Never mind those pesky little high-energy electron beams that magically appeared. They had their hands full with just reconstructing the dirtier-than-expected nucleus. Other features of the photos should have told them something also. For example, the light was coming from the nucleus and shining outwards, getting fainter as one looked away from the nucleus. If this light were from the sun, the only source of energy in their model, then the light should have been higher to the sunward side of the nucleus, dimming as it reached the nucleus. As before, no one ever bothered to notice or ask those questions. Actually, some were asking those questions, but they were labeled as troublemakers, pseudoscientists, and crackpots. And anyway, who would listen to someone who had been fired for incompetence in trying to publish incorrect science? Part 3, Fluffiest. We are a full 14 years since the Halley's debacle. And so this was written in, by the way, this three-act play was put in my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, in around the year 2000. That's what this 14 years is referring to. So part 3, Fluffiest. We are a full 14 years since the Halley's debacle. Other space probes have now confirmed that there is no water or ice on the comet nucleus, and additionally, that there are no cracks or pockets of ice either. Scientists are now hoping that the ice and the snow is somewhere beneath the hot rocky surface they have recorded. But even if there were water somewhere locked inside, there is no water production that would have to be there to account for the tons of water and ice moving out from the comet nucleus per second. Essentially, the nucleus would have to look like a massive steam locomotive, but instead, when a comet nucleus is observed at close range, no water and no ice and no outgassing of any kind is observed. In brief, the Dirty Snowball Comet model has been disproven by those who have PhDs in this, and they simply refuse to give up the ghost. In addition to these crimes against science, other data were taken of Comet Halley, including spectroscopic data collected by professional astronomers with professional-grade equipment paid for with your tax dollars that showed the comet nucleus giving off a distinctive redshift. That data was squelched too. Comets certainly do not give off redshifted light, a property usually associated with massive stars and galaxies. The cause of this redshift is detailed in the appendix of my previously published works. Not more than 6 years later, a new comet entered the solar system. It had been here before not more than 4,200 years ago. We called it Hale-Bopp. The ancients certainly had another name for it, as they did for the planet Venus, which was a huge comet before it was a planet in the not-too-distant past. But of course, the ancients who observed these and other comets and handed down the legends of the damage they had inflicted on planet Earth were all trained savages with no knowledge of orbital mechanics. Their fanciful tales of Jupiter throwing lightning bolts across the heavens to Mars and the many Earth changes were just figments of their primitive imagination, according to NASA. With a budget of $14 billion a year that is Congress-proof, and with the largest collection of equipment and PhDs ever amassed by mankind, the elite core of scientists at NASA could not possibly be wrong. Comets by edict are dirty snowballs, and anyone who suggests otherwise must be a poorly educated, ridiculously misguided pseudoscientist with a secret agenda to gain notoriety amongst the populace by creating fear and misinformation about what all good followers know are harmless, tiny little snowballs. And everyone lived happily ever after. That's the end of the three-part play, Fluff, Fluffier, and Fluffiest. And that's just a small example of the insanity that has raged over decades and decades, and it's still going on today. But let me just insert this now, because I'll take an example here. I was on Art Bell's show one night, and we were doing a Christmas special on the Russian space program. This is back in the 90s. I would do a Christmas special with Art, even though he was an atheist. We had this thing where we would do a Christmas special. So we're talking about the Russian space program, and we get into the topic of my work. And he asked the question. He said, "Jim," he says, "your comet theory is clearly correct. You know, this dirty snowball thing couldn't possibly be correct. And it's very clear." He said, "What's going on here? How come they just will not drop this dead horse, this dead dog of a theory?" I said, "Well, it's because of the publications and all the textbooks and the college textbooks and the peer review publication and the egg on the face." And, I went on with a list of things like that. And Art goes, "Well, wait, no. He said, "There's something bigger going on here." And Art was a really perceptive guy. He's one of the most perceptive people I've met in my life. And he said, "Something else is going on here. Something bigger is going on." Because he said, they could take you, they could kill you, they could steal your work, they could put their name on it, they could pretend like they knew it all along, or whatever. They could cover it up, they could do something to take this out or change it, and then this would become the standard theory and nobody would be any the wiser. They put a bunch of headline banners around it, NASA discovers plasma discharge comet model, and he said, "But something bigger is going on here." And it took me a lot of years to put that together. And it is really true, because comets are essential to understanding so many things. And one of is our direct past. If you look at the Carl Sagan Cosmos series, it is all based on evolution from the Big Bang and the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago. Nothing has happened since. There's nothing that's crashed into Earth. There's nothing, maybe a couple little asteroids here and there, maybe that destroyed the dinosaurs, but nothing big. You know, it's so long ago, we could forget about that. And the whole idea is to keep the public in this idea that nothing could happen to planet Earth, nothing major. And so that's one of them, but it's a control mechanism. And this is where it comes right down to the bottom line. And I'll be just very clear about this. I talk about this on my radio show, that the CIA took over NASA in 1991. Dan Golden came in from the CIA. And this is when Hale-Bopp was first discovered And at that point, they were calling it Planet X. And my book that is currently available, Planet X 2020, the real history of Planet X, goes through this whole detail of what's going on. But the CIA is the police force of the World Bank. And the World Bank controls literally all of the governments of the world through the banking system and through an investment and ownership of the big international corporations, which filter down. The very few really independent major corporations on Earth, they are sucked up and bought up. And all the social media, all the news media, etc., are owned by the CIA through little companies, etc. But when they took over NASA, when the CIA took over NASA, they put the lid on and they put in publication release agencies. One was at Goddard, one was at JPL, and one was in Houston. And so these agencies had people that were in charge of filtering and monitoring any information that came out of NASA. And so the NASA scientists could not walk up to a microphone and say anything. They had to write it out, and then it went through these filtering agencies and before it was allowed to go into public consumption. And that was to prevent anything like the Jonathan Eberhardt event from ever happening again, where he was working for Science News and he wrote up a favorable article mentioning me. And this was right after all of this that I'm talking about. That's when that article hit. And so anyway, what Art Bell was telling me was that something big is going on. And that's clearly the case. The paranoia in the intelligence community around the issue of Hale-Bopp was immense. It was enormous. It was just off the scale. And that is because the Planet X object that was discovered by Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory had a 4,200-year orbit, and not 3,600 years. It was 4,200 years and 4,250 to be exact. And it was on a direct collision course with Earth. And it later became the nucleus of Hale-Bopp with a companion. And it slowed down. It was had its orbit reduced to 2,600 years, almost half its original orbit. And so it dropped into a lower orbit and it had slowed down. So by the time it crossed the ecliptic, where Earth should have been, Earth had already moved ahead about 90 days in its orbit. So we were a full quarter of the way around our orbit, and it did not come close to Earth at all. And so anyway, by this time, however, that whole issue, I'll be talking more about those details, but it's important to understand here why, in the face of clear-cut, extensive data, nose-to-nose data with comets, we've now, in the year 2020, there have been many, many, many visits to comets, and they're all black and tarred surfaces, etc. No ice or water. They're hot. They're extremely hot, etc. And absolutely absurd to believe that this is a snowball. But it continues, and it's like the flat Earth, which is also being promulgated by the CIA, where a lot of people think, oh, the Earth is flat. And there are people believing this. There are people out there believing this, you know. But the flat Earth thing started in the Middle Ages, and it was to keep people mentally sequestered. And so the same issue is going on in a very bizarre way with objects from outer space, including comets. Cometary phenomena was essential to understanding the life of Christ. And I'm not going to go through that here because... It's a very complex topic. I've talked about this on other radio shows, but it's not apropos for this point in time. But the entire issue, it comes down to the following. When the public looks up into the sky and sees a comet, traditionally, going back thousands of years, it's kind of like a deer in the woods that smells the scent of man. It knows instinctively that that's danger. And so even a little fawn deer will run away when it smells the scent of man. It's instinctive. When man looks up into the heavens and sees a comet, they instinctively think of danger and of destruction, of earthwide destruction. And the reality is that most small comets are going to fly by and really not have any effect at all. the event at Tunguska, where there's a big massive explosion, forest blown down in a circular pattern for 20 miles around. It broke windows 100 miles away when the explosion hit, and not a trace of an object hitting the Earth there. And it was an electrical discharge from a comet that was passing by. So anyway, that's one issue. But the whole point here is that when people look up into the sky and see a comet, they think disaster. It's just a natural feeling. So they want to do everything possible to squelch this idea that comets are anything but just this little fluffy snowball. They have all of these names, the little icy wanderers, fluffy snowballs, icy wanderer from beyond, and that they come from this imaginary region in outer space called the Oort cloud, which nobody ever could measure or determine with equipment. Absolutely impossible. It's just another figment. It's in every textbook. Go to any college textbook in astronomy and you will find a description of the Oort cloud, which is a fantasy. Nobody could ever prove it. This is not science. This is all fantasy world. And so here's the crux issue. Being the leaders, and by the way, when Hale-Bopp came into the solar system, the Vatican, which owns the Vatican Bank with the Rothschild banking empire, is the front agency for the Vatican Bank, which basically operates the world, governments, etc., through the banking system. And if you don't know about that, then you're just missing the boat. You don't have any idea what's going on or who runs the planet. But that's another issue. But they are so paranoid of their control, and they know that when people look up in the sky and see a comet, their natural instinct is, number one, to think of danger and disaster, etc. But number two is that the immediate calculation in any mind would be that, hey, this government of ours doesn't have any control over that thing out there. They might have control over the stock market and the jobless rate and the inflation rate and wars and all of this other stuff, but they don't have any control of that thing out there. That is what Art Bell was talking about. That's what he was saying. There was something else in control of this need to maintain this dirty snowball comet model for the general public. That is what it's all about, is control. Because they would lose control if and this is the whole world, because the world is spinning around, and in a given day, the whole planetary population of Earth would look up and see this thing, and in one day, they would lose their control because of a large comet up in the sky. And they don't want that. When they had all of the disinformation about Planet X that raged through the late 1990s into the early 2000s, into the 2000s, and even up to today, they're still raging on the internet. Planet X due tomorrow. Planet X, Planet X. And I was, just to be clear on this, when all of this was raging in the early 2000s, I was the only sane voice regarding this whole thing that know that there was not a Planet X object coming on May 15th, 2003. It turned out it was going to be a full moon, a very strange orange full moon. And NASA was very involved in that whole disinformation program. Crazy lady talks to aliens. It was NASA supplying her with photographs and understanding that on this date, May 15th, 2003, there would be this strange full moon that was big and orange. And so, of course, every cover of every book of these Planet X books had a big orange ball on the cover. And that's what they were saying you should expect Planet X to look like. No, it would be a large comet. So do you see the massive amount of misinformation that they have undertaken to squelch the idea that comets would be anything but this fluffy little icy wander dirty snowball? And all of the people at NASA, the Tier 2 scientists, have to abide by this. They cannot go outside of these boundaries. But, of course, they're Tier 2 scientists. They're not very bright. The Carl Sagans and the NASA boys, etc., that you see in public, not very bright people. it doesn't take a lot to get a PhD in astronomy and or even space science. It's almost like just learn these few rules, etc. And you know, and I'm not knocking them too much, but really they're not very bright people. And I saw this when I was at Cornell, excuse me, but these were not the brightest bulbs on the tree that I ever saw. And they were more arrogant than good, let's just put it that way. And because of their arrogance, they could put out some theory, and that had to be because they were so-and-so, that theory had to stick. But they were the perfect candidates for Tier 2 science. Arrogant people who think they're right no matter what they say, etc. But anyway, back to this core theme, that is the core reason, and that's what Art Bell said to me. And he didn't really, he was probing, but it was a good probing question as to why is it that clearly what I was doing is correct. The Dirty Snowball Comet model is ludicrous. It's not even ridiculous. Take ludicrous to the 10th power today with all of the data that is available is absolutely beyond absurd. Absurdity to the 10th power, yet it still remains. And so I think it's important to establish why this is. It is because of the fear of control of the people that operate and control the world, because they would lose control overnight to the entire world population through their control mechanisms. All of their control mechanisms, the news, the internet, social media, government spokespersons, scientists, all of NASA, European Space Agency, all of this immense effort would be gone overnight when people looked up to the sky and saw this major, major raging comet. And then if it started to have action at a distance, interactions with Earth, people would really know, hey, my government doesn't have any control over this. Not a bit. Sorry. Sayonara. You know, you no need to pay your house bill, your insurance bill, or the schooling for your kids, or, on and on and on, or watch the nightly news about the stock report. None of this would be important because that thing up there in the sky dominates what is going on planet Earth. So that is what the core issue is here, and that's why they have to continue this charade, this veil, this absolute absurdity of the Dirty Snowball Comet model. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the space probes that went to Halley's Comet, pick them apart one by one and give a discussion of each one. And it's because this 1980s was a very rich time for cometary science. And the event at Halley's Comet was probably the pinnacle of all of this. So this is very important information. And once again, my comet work is at the central core of all of this, dealing with what are comets really made of. And then also their physical size, because a comet is a lot of people think, well, it's this nucleus and then there's the tail and that's it. Well, no, there's a lot going on here that you cannot see, that you have no visibility, and you need very special instrumentation to see it in its entirety. And the size of the comet, electrically and magnetically, is enormous. It could be 10, 20, 100 million miles long, literally. But the nucleus in the visible coma might be 10 miles across, and the coma might be 100,000 miles across and maybe 200,000 miles long, something like that. But the electrical size of the comet is enormous, thousands and thousands of times bigger than what the visible part of the comet is. Okay, before I segue into the next section here, which I'll be dealing with, a couple other papers that were written in the 1980s. And so just in review, The Dynamics of a Small Comet was written for that time frame of the mid-1980s, dealing specifically with the ISWE-3 satellite going to Jacobini's Inner, but also dealing with the upcoming approach to Halley's Comet, etc. And then there was other papers. Here's one that I'll be dealing with in a minute. Here it's called Currents Induced in Non-Uniform Plasmas. And this, I'll read out the full title here. Currents Induced by Foreign Objects in Non-Uniform Plasma. And so anyway, once again, this is a paper dealing with just the plasma discharge itself. And so not relating to comets. And sometimes I would do this at an American Geophysical Union meeting, which I should mention too. I attended these regularly through the 80s, through the 90s, through the 2000s, etc. And of course, when I was there, the NASA scientists all knew who I was. And it was like they would stand there and they'd look at me like in kind of bewilderment. But I know a lot of them secretly understood what I was doing, but they couldn't say anything. They were hogtied in their contracts, etc. And I would get comments like the two guys I went into a meeting. They were sitting at a table. The meeting that was supposed to be taking place for the it was a solar physics meeting, for some reason didn't happen. So there's just these two scientists sitting at a table talking, and they looked at me. They knew who I was, and they were talking about the talk was on magnetohydrodynamics, which was the field of study that Hans Alfvén began, and they said, you know, this stuff doesn't work. And I said, yeah, I know it. It doesn't work. Magnetohydrodynamics doesn't work. But let me lead with a question here. What do the following three people have in common? Hans Alfvén, Albert Einstein, and Nikola Tesla. Now, just to give you an idea of the answer, Nikola Tesla died in 1943, Albert Einstein, 1955, and Hans Alfvén, 1995. So Hans Alfvén was older. He lived longer into the space program, but actually, they all were prior to the real intense part of the space program. And so, and especially Tesla and Einstein. Hans Alfvén won a Nobel Prize for his work on what they called or magnetohydrodynamics. And what is that? That kind of talks about magnetic fields as if they just existed. And this is the whole real problem with what Alfvén did, is that, and there again, it's not his fault, because he did not have the information available. And the same way with Einstein and Tesla, I've talked about that before. They died before the information was really readily available to them. But the idea with Hans Alfvén that magnetic fields simply exist in outer space and that you can explain electrical currents and electrical phenomena as a result of magnetic fields is incorrect. What I did when I came along, I said, okay, that's backwards. The magnetic fields are not going to exist unless you have currents. And now you can have permanent magnetic fields like a bar magnet or a piece of iron that has a magnetic field solidified in it. It was in a magnetic field when it solidified through the Curie temperature. The Curie temperature is the temperature at which the magnetic field is locked into the material, nickel, iron, etc. The Curie temperature is the temperature at which the magnetic field is locked into the material in the solid. In other words, the little atoms are locked in place. It's a solid. They're not going to move anymore, and their magnetic fields are aligned. So it gives you a bar magnet, and the Earth has some of this in its mantle primarily, not so much in its core, but in its mantle. And so that gives Earth somewhat of a permanent magnetic field. But the idea that in plasma physics that magnetic fields simply exist is ludicrous. I mean, it's not correct. You can have a changing magnetic field that induces electric fields because of the Lorentz equations, the way the magnetic and electric fields work together. And so magnetic fields. Potentially, in fact, an electric motor does that all the time, where you have a physical winding and you turn that in a magnetic field, and then it causes electric current to flow. But in a plasma, you don't have a couple things. You do not have charges contained inside a wire. They're free. They're in space. They're not captured within that wire. And so that's a big difference. And secondly, magnetic fields would simply dissipate without a current to maintain them. So let's take Earth's permanent magnetic field for example. Earth has a permanent magnetic field up in its crust. And if you're a Boy Scout, you take your compass and you walk around. Or if you're a surveyor, you have a compass, potentially. And you can determine north, the general north direction of Earth, etc. But it's not very reliable. But the Earth in general has a permanent magnetic field. Well, how did it get that permanent magnetic field? It had to be cooling that iron, that nickel, etc., that maintains that permanent magnetic field, had to be above the Curie temperature for a time, and then cooling down and cooling down, and that does not take, that's not something that happens overnight. And so you would have to have the Earth immersed in an external magnetic field. This is how you make a magnet. You take a piece of iron or nickel, primarily iron or other rare earth metals, etc., or materials today that they use to make very powerful magnets, and you put it in a strong magnetic field, and then you cool it down. And as it cools through the Curie temperature, the magnetic field is locked inside the magnet. Okay, so for Earth to have a permanent magnetic field, it had to cool over a long, geologically long period of time. So where was the external magnetic field that was surrounding Earth that this was involved in, where the Earth had the materials as they cooled down over millions of years? There was a permanent magnetic field that existed, but it had to be a plasma magnetic field. So what caused that? Well, magnetic fields just don't exist on their own in plasma physics. And that's one of the big errors that Hans Alvin made. And there again, he didn't understand the fact that magnetic fields just don't simply exist. You need electric currents to cause the magnetic fields to exist. But where does the electric current come from? What keeps that electric current going all the time? Well, you need a potential difference. Where does the potential difference come from? It comes from the only source of electrical energy in the solar system, the fusion of the sun. And so now, if you understand this logical train, people like Hans Alvin did not understand this, and this has unfortunately carried over into modern astrophysics, where they still keep talking and train new PhDs in the mythology of magnetohydrodynamics, that somehow magnetic fields and plasma just exist. They're just there, boys and girls. It's totally incorrect, unfortunately. And so it's very important to understand the history of development. And then what happened when I came along is I went through that logical progression because, number one, I have a very good physics background and I understand the dynamics of electric and magnetic fields. I also understand that you cannot have contained currents in a plasma like you have contained currents in a wire. Those electrons can't escape from the wire, so they're held within the wire, and so when you have a changing magnetic field, it causes the current to flow in the wire. In a plasma, that current, instead of flowing in the wire and being able to be used for a useful power, counteracts the magnetic field and dissipates the magnetic field. Just like you cannot have free charge in outer space, it just is there. It's neutralized very quickly. You cannot have free magnetic fields in plasma in outer space. It simply is not possible. So the whole concept of magnetohydrodynamics is wrong. It's based on a fallacy. It's not based on good science. And so when you go through the logical progression that magnetic fields do not exist in outer space in plasma physics, they don't just simply exist. And if they did exist, they would not last long because there would be current flow that would neutralize them very quickly. You cannot have free charges, electric charges in outer space, because they would be neutralized in plasma physics in very short order. And so how do you get magnetic fields in plasmas then? The only way to do it is with continual electrical currents. Well, you can't have continual electrical currents just existing in outer space. Where do they come from? The only way current can flow is if you have a potential difference. Well, where does the potential difference come from? Because it would be neutralized very quickly if you didn't have a source of power that was generating the electric fields on a continual basis. So this logic led me to understand that the sun fusion is up at the surface of the sun. It is creating the solar wind. There's an excess current of protons in the solar wind. And I needed to understand what the driving force was for the charged nucleus of a comet, because it can't just exist. You can't have just a charge on a comet nucleus that keeps drawing in material on an ongoing basis forever. It just doesn't happen. That's why the people like some of Velikovsky's supporters, like Juergens and the other ones, did not understand these concepts either, because they were not plasma physicists. They did not understand the difference between electrical circuits in a circuit board and electrical circuits in outer space. They are not the same. They are very different. They are not the same. And so this led me to understand, and then when I saw the proton winds with the Voyager spacecraft coming off of Jupiter and more so off of Saturn, it was very clear that these are small stars. The fusion process is up in the atmosphere. There's not enough material at the core of Jupiter nor Saturn to have core fusion, and so therefore the sun does not have it either. And then the Russians did the experiment where they literally measured the core temperature of the sun, found it was cooler than the atmospheric temperature of the sun, and game over. But of course, none of this is recognized in Western science, and they're still laboring over this idea that magnetohydrodynamics, magnetic fields just exist on their own, totally incorrect. So I'm pounding on this point because this is core and central to the complete understanding of what's really going on in outer space. How do comets maintain electric fields? How do they maintain an electric charge? Well, they're simply discharging a much bigger power source. They're, in a sense, passive characters in a very active system. The capacitor is built by the sun's fusion, and so the sun's fusion is the source of not only light, but an electric field. Okay, so now this tells you, where does Earth's energy come from for weather? From the same electric field. If we did not have electrical discharges of the Earth in the local solar capacitor, we would not have lightning, we would not have clouds, hurricanes, tornadoes, cyclones, waterspouts, wind. We would not have any weather at all if it were not for the electric fields. Tesla understood that the vertical electric field was there. He could measure it. You can measure it. He tapped into it. He could drive the electricity he gathered through the ground at a designated RFC circuit, radio frequency circuit, through the ground that was an optimal resonance frequency for the ground. He could do the same thing with the Wardenclyffe Tower. But he did not know where the electric field came from. Okay, so with this in mind, now I'm going to go into a paper. It's called Currents Induced by Foreign Objects in Non-Uniform Plasmas, 1987, the American Geophysical Union meeting. And like I say, the reason I wrote this paper, it's not about comets. It is, but it doesn't mention them in the sense that all I'm doing here is describing a physical process. And once again, this little paper of its own should be a Nobel Prize winning paper, because it's one of those papers that gives the key fundamental understanding to non-uniform plasmas. Now, non-uniform is very important here. What's a non-uniform plasma? A non-uniform plasma is one in which the charge is distributed unevenly. So you have negative over here or pockets of positive over there, etc. So it's non-uniform. A uniform plasma is one in which the charge is uniformly distributed, the plus and the negative charges, and it's in a gaseous state. So the electrons are separated from the atoms. When an electron is sitting there, it looks out, and if you took all of the rest of the atoms in the plasma away and you just left one, say, nucleus there, let's say a carbon that was ionized, and you had just one electron, they would see each other and they would be attracted towards each other. But in the neutral plasma, the electron looks out and it just sees neutrality. There's nothing to attract it. There's no balanced positive charge to attract that electron. So the electron is just kind of sitting there, looking around, going, well, I'm an electron. If there's anybody positive out there, I'd be love to just go racing over directly to you. But in a neutral plasma, there is no singular charge. So the electrons sit there, the positive ions sit there and look out, so they're free to exist in this kind of a sea of charge, and they're not accelerated in any given direction. It's a uniform plasma. A non-uniform plasma is a different situation. You have positive charge and negative charge in groups separated. Now, what happens when a foreign object comes in to this region? Now, if you look at what comets do, the solar capacitor is this big nebular ion cloud that surrounds the sun out beyond the orbit of Jupiter. That's where the Kuiper Belt objects are forming via comet processes, plasma discharge comet processes. But the solar system has a non-uniform field. So when the objects come in, which are just chunks of rock from outside the solar system, they come in, and they are bringing in the charge level of the plasma where they enter the solar system. And then they start to discharge it because they're like putting an electrical finger into the plasma, into the non-uniform plasma. Okay, but that's a specific case of an object coming into the non-uniform electric field of the solar system. This paper is just a fundamental theoretical paper, nothing more, nothing less. Okay, so I'm going to take snippets out of this paper. It's quite a long paper. 1987, Currents Induced by Foreign Bodies in Non-Uniform Plasmas. Abstract, a class of plasma physics problem is discussed in which currents are induced when a foreign object passes through a plasma with a non-uniform charge distribution. This paper makes a first pass at defining parameters, providing solution techniques, and general results. Interpretations and discussion of possible examples are left to future papers. Introduction. And here's, I'll read some of this, and then I'll go through the general results. In the classical treatment of plasma physics problems involving an object shielded by a space charge sheath. Now, what I'm talking about here is if you go to any classical plasma physics book, this is what they deal with, because they assume what they call Chapman physics, that if there's a charge there, it's going to have a space charge sheath, and kind of like an atom, it's a neutral entity if you're outside of that. And that's the way they treat charged objects in outer space. And what I'm saying here is that when you have an object coming in to a non-uniform plasma that do exist, I mean, they're out there, the non-uniform plasmas, something different happens, something that is not taken into account in the classical textbook example. So anyway, once again, in the classical treatment of plasma physics problems involving an object shielded by a space charge sheath, simplifying assumptions are made which reduce their applicability to the non-uniform charge distribution case. This paper hopes to clarify what results cannot be carried over to the non-uniform case and what further considerations are needed. So this paper is a seminal paper. It is very important because nobody really understood this. Nobody was expecting this. Nobody understood that non-uniform electric fields acted differently than uniform fields. Okay, and then I give an example. For example, when shielding distances are calculated, the Debye shielding length, the inherent assumption is made that the object resides in a uniform plasma, a plasma which has been reduced to its state of minimum electrical potential. It is also assumed that the charged object simply exists in the neutral plasma. It is not important from a theoretical viewpoint where or how it became charged in the plasma. If any non-uniformity ever existed, the charge would have quickly moved under strong electrical forces until the uniform plasma was maintained. This is the classical textbook treatment of the problem. It is often quoted by investigators in many cases where it does not apply. For example, numerous private communications and conversations that I've had with people. Reading on. In the non-uniform plasma case, the Debye length calculation, this is the shielding length, this is the distance of shielding around the object. In the non-uniform plasma case, the Debye length calculation must be modified, and the path that the object takes, its velocity relative to the plasma, becomes important. Where and how it became charged must be determined, and charge-to-mass ratio of electrons, ions, and particles, dust particles, etc., and the object become important factors to consider. None of this, I'm just going to step aside and talk a little bit about this. None of this has been considered previously to my 1987 paper. Okay, reading on. The plasma relaxation time in the presence of the passing object will be compared to that which would occur if the object were not present. In other words, how would this plasma relax and become a neutral plasma relative to the case where the object comes through the plasma that is non-uniform? Okay, this presents a complex but interesting class of plasma physics problem where signatures are detectable by spacecraft instrumentation, sometimes at great distances from the object, and whose principles can be demonstrated at the laboratory. Okay, and I just noticed I'm out of time for this show, so I'm going to pick up this topic the next time, continue talking about this very important paper, 1987. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.